Today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures, a five-generation Georgia-based beef and poultry farm determined to conduct business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com.
Broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to Chef's Story. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from the International Culinary Center. And today I've got a very exciting show lined up. We have with us none other than he's been called the Obi-Wan Kenobi of chefs when he was on Top Chef, Master Chefs, Jonathan Waxman. And for all of you out there, I'm sure all of you have heard about Jonathan, but let me just put you in the picture here. You know, we know that James Beard's been called the father of American cuisine, but there was a revolution in the 70s and 80s of young Americans rediscovering, American cuisine and taking the best techniques from Europe and flavor profiles and bringing it back to the United States and making it a new American cuisine. And if there was any chef that I would put at the pinnacle of that movement, and I would call, maybe I'll go out on a limb and call him the father of modern American cuisine, it's Jonathan Waxman. That's who you're going to hear from today. So put on your seatbelts. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thank you, Dorothy.
Well, okay, so you were a trombone player that grew up in Oakland.
Right. You know, it's a funny, sort of, picaresque journey that most chefs go on. And I think all chefs, the common thread really is that you didn't start off life wanting to be a chef. That just never was part of your world or your lexicon.
We're talking 70s, 60s, 70s.
I think until, the advent of TV in the mid-90s, I don't think anybody aspired really to be a chef. No one woke up in the morning and said, I want to be a chef the rest of my life. And I grew up in a household in Berkeley, California. My parents loved food. My grandparents had a ranch in Sonoma. My uncles had a ranch in Sonoma. I spent every weekend, either polishing eggs or working in the vegetable garden, which I really hated, by the way. it smelled like manure. There was hard work. It was cloudy. It was dusty, et cetera. And chickens, I'm sorry, are not the nicest animals on the planet. And I let the cow out of the barn once and see my blind grandfather running down the road chasing his cow. Kind of put me off farms forever. But, one thing that happened was my parents really took me out to eat a lot. They took us to tons of different kinds of restaurants. And one thing, my father just passed away this past April at age 90. He loved going to ethnic restaurants. And one of his favorite restaurants was a Chinese restaurant called Sun Hun Yung down in downtown Chinatown. And there were three levels. There was the levels for the people off the street like us. And there was a second level, which was kind of commingling of real Chinese and us. And then the top floor was only Chinese diners. No one was else was allowed. My father always said, let's go to the third floor. That's where the good food is. And that's the kind of person he was. He really loved food. He was very passionate about it. And so he imbued us with that sort of sense of good food and different things. And, when I was in high school, I just wanted to be a trombone player. I just wanted to play jazz and I wanted to play, rock and roll. And that's what I aspired to be. And I got a scholarship to the University of Nevada at Reno, and I played I played with Sammy Davis Jr. in the pit orchestras. I played in rock and roll bands. I played in orchestras, and I was a pretty good player, but I wasn't the best player on the planet. And I kind of knew that in the back of my head, but I kept pushing it. And when I was about 20, 21 years old, I got a job playing in Hawaii in a band. And this band broke up in Hawaii, and all my surfer buddies go, so you have two options here. You can either sell drugs or work in a restaurant. So I said, I'm not going to sell drugs. I'll figure it out. So I went to work for a restaurant. I went to work for the Rusty Harpoon in Kaanapali Beach in Maui, which was more of like a grill your own steak and lobster place. And I became a busser, and I became a a part-time cook, part-time dishwasher, and I quickly rose to be the manager somehow. I don't know how that happened. Along the way, I was a bartender, et cetera, et cetera. But I got bit by the bug, by the restaurant bug. Mm. And so when I came, my father said, you know, you got to come back and get a real job. So I came back to Berkeley, and he said, you know, let's get you a job. I said, I don't want a job. I want to play trombone. He goes, no, that's not going to work in life. So I got a job as a part-time bartender, but I also got a job selling Ferraris for Steve Griswold in Berkeley, California. Now, Steve Griswold was this amazing character. I could spend hours on him. But Steve Griswold's wife knew Mary Risley at Tom Marie Cooking School in San Francisco, and she said, you should go to cooking school. I said, what's that? You know, she goes, don't worry about it. I'll sign you up. So I took a six-week course in Mary Risley, and I fell in love. And I fell in love with Mary. I fell in love with French cuisine. I fell in love with the whole gestalt of what French food was. And at the same time, Chez Panisse had just opened up. So I was eating at Chez Panisse every day. And something weird kind of happened. And Mary goes, you should become a chef. And I said, what's a chef? She goes, don't worry about it. I'm going to sign you up. So unbeknownst to me, she canvassed the Cordon Bleu in London and La Varenne in Paris. And the Cordon Bleu in London didn't have any space. But La Varenne had, someone had dropped out and they had a space for me. So she said, it's $6,000 for a year. It's a grand diploma course. It's a 9-month course. You're going to go. So I went to my parents. They said, okay, well, here's your $6,000. I don't know how else you're going to get money, but see you later. And I arrived on my birthday, November 15th in 1976. Wow. And it was
The francs to the dollar were pretty good in those days.
It was pretty good. And I lived in this little boarding house that, you know, had, which actually is now a fancy hotel called the Duc Saint-Simon. And I met a guy. I went to Alliance Française and I met this fashion photographer named
Chuck. So you didn't speak any French?
Not at all.
But La Ferrand was in English. It was Anne Willen's school.
I went to Alliance Française and I met this guy named Chuck Baker who was living with all his models. Mm-hmm. And it's famous. And so I live with these models and these fashion
Jonathan,
guys.
What a life.
And so, you know, I was going to school. I was going to cooking school. I was going to language school. And I was hanging out with these models. And I had a pretty good time. But at the same time, what was going on in France is that the French all of a sudden were rediscovering food. It was the days of the trois gros. And it was the days of, you know, Roger Verger and Michel Gerard and all these people. And I was reading about these guys all the time, especially in school. And then one day in school, somebody said, there's this great chef that's not in France. He's in Switzerland. His name is Freddy Girardet. And you got to go there. So that became the sort of the holy grail of how to get to this guy at Crissier. And I never figured out how to do that while I was in school. But at the end of school, I was very lucky because Gregory Usher was unfortunately not with us anymore, who was a fantastic guy, arranged to get me a job in a restaurant in the Vosges. It was a one-star Michelin restaurant. And I got
the Vosges Mountains.
Near Basel.
Okay.
Near where Frederick is from. Futter is from.
Yeah.
And I went there, and I arrived in this little one-horse town, and they showed me to my bed, which I think the pigs used to sleep in. And I worked from 8 o'clock in the morning to 1 o'clock in the morning every day, and I did everything. There was
How
a
long
chef.
Were you there for?
I was there for the summer, and then my mother became ill, and I had to come home. I didn't weigh much anyway, but I weighed about 110 pounds by the end of the whole affair. But it was the funny thing. I had a working permit. I had a carte de travail, so I was able to work and get paid, which I didn't realize that I was one of like four people in all of France that from America that had that. Anyway, so I came back to America, and my mother needed some care. And I knew Hank Rubin, who at that time was the wine editor for Food and Wine magazine, and he was a family friend. He goes, you should go work at this new place called Domaine Chandon. Mm-hmm. So I walked to Domaine Chandon, you know, French restaurant, you know. And
Up
in Napa Valley, and I got a job there, and I just had the most fantastic time. It was really great. And it was Udo Nahutnis and me, and Philippe Gentil. And I met Philippe was fantastic. He was this little punk kid from Epernay in France in the Champagne region, but he had more skill set than any chef that I'd ever met in France. And he taught me amazing things. And I went from there to this little restaurant in Monterey, California. I was there for about a month. But in the meantime, I had applied for Chez Panisse.
And what year is this?
We're talking 1977.
So you had to apply even in those years.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I got a call from Alice, and she called my home, actually. And they called, well, this woman named Alice Waters is calling. She wants you to come. So in those days, you had to audition for Chez Panisse.
What was the audition?
The audition, you had to cook dinner for Alice and her friends on Monday night. So I cooked dinner. It was horrendous, this dinner. And it was, I tried to emulate this meal that I'd had at the Trois Gros Brothers, which was the stupidest thing in the world. And they were very polite about the whole thing, and they waded their way through the meal. At the end of it, they didn't say anything, and I went away. And I got a call a week later. Al said, I think we have a spot for you. Now, what had happened was Mark Miller, who was a line cook in those days, had left, and they needed someone to come and cook, so I took over Mark Miller's space. But it was funny, because Judy Rogers did lunch.
It
was Jean-Pierre Moulet, Alice, and me.
Oh.
And Lindsay Scheer was the pastry chef. And Deborah Madison was a prep cook.
No.
And it was an amazing place to be.
My gosh, it's like...
Yeah, it was... So, you know, and I wasn't there a very long time, but I was there long enough to really get...
Can you remember the menu you made for Alice? The Trois Gros menu?
Oh, I can't remember, but no. I'll dredge it up somehow. It's kind of embarrassing. But I was very lucky to be with Alice when she was right at the... when she was just feeling exactly where she wanted to be in the world, mm-hmm. where she had gone through all these other chefs and, you know, with Jeremiah Tower and all these different people, and she really felt comfortable, and she knew what she wanted, and it was brilliant being with her, because she looked at food in a much different way, because she wasn't classically trained, and she didn't go to cooking school, and she didn't have all that sort of, like, it has to be done this way. She just figured out the way she wanted to do it. And I watched her butcher something one day, and I looked at her, and I realized how intelligent she is and how careful she is and how beautifully she does things. And it really is inspiring. It's just amazing to watch someone like that. And she was very rigorous about how she wanted things to be, and the flowers had to be a certain way, and you know, all these different ingredients. I was incredibly lucky to be there.
Wait. So let's go back to that butchering piece. Because she wasn't a trained butcher. So how did she butcher?
Well, she took it was a filet mignon, and it was a whole filet. In those days, you would get it with all the fat and everything on it. And she started cutting it into steaks with the fat and everything on it. I was always trained to take all the fat off, all the sinew, and cut it down to the, you know, just the bare meat. She was cutting it so she left a little layer of fat around there. So when she grilled it, the fat had flavor into the meat. And I was just like, oh my God, this is so cool. You know,
so intelligent.
You know, and so intelligent, but it just so thoughtful.
Yeah,
and you know, it does something to you. It's that light that goes on that really inspires you, but also it sort of forces you to get your game up. Mm-hmm. And that's what Alice really did for me. It was really forced me to realize that, you know, I had to get better. I had to get better. I had to get better quick. And I better read more. I better go out in the field. And she sent me foraging. She sent me to buy salmon. She really was very mentoring in a very wonderful way. And, you know, it's inspiring the way she teaches people. And I thank her to this day.
Mm. So what books did you start reading, and where did you go after that?
Well, I spent a lot of time, and there was a library in Richmond, California, that was a public library, and had tons of French books, Italian books. I read books on Chinese food. I just ran the gamut. I just wanted to... You know, the old gourmet magazines that went back to the 40s and 50s, those were fantastic. I mean, amazing. And they're really travelogues of a time and a place where food it looked amazing. And, of course, I read Julia Child voraciously and everything else. But, you know, I watched Graham Kerr on TV. You know, anything food-wise, I devoured. I inhaled it. I went to as many restaurants as I could. I read as much literature as I could, and I went to the markets. I became obsessed. I think that's what happens with chefs. You become incredibly obsessed, and you don't think about anything else. You get tunnel vision, and that tunnel vision provides you with the platform to do well, I think.
It's called super focus.
Whatever it is. Whatever that is.
So how did you get down to Michael's?
Well, it's funny. My dream after Chez Panisse was to go to work at Lutèce in New York. Mm-hmm. I don't know why, but I had gone there with some people from Chez Panisse, and I'd eaten there, and I just fell in love with Lutèce. And I felt that's what I wanted to do. Along the way, I decided to go to L.A. to see what the scene was like, and I ran into this guy, Ken Frank, who was just working at this place called La Guillotine. And he said, I'm going to become the chef of this new restaurant called Michael's in Santa Monica. Maybe you should go by and talk to Michael McCarty. So I drove out to Michael's, and it was Michael's in the midst of construction, 6 months behind. And Michael goes, I've been looking for you. I said, what do you mean you're looking for me? He goes, I've been looking for you for 2 years.
You personally?
Me personally. And I said, how is that? And he said, I called up Lavran and asked who would be good candidates to be a cook in my new restaurant in Los Angeles. And your name came up first. But we didn't know where you were. So it was kind of one of those really crazy things where, like, he goes, I'll give you a job right now, but you'd have to be a sous chef under Ken. I said, I don't care. So I took the job. I lived at Michael's house. It was like this sort of this, you know, this little commune of people that were building the restaurant. We finished the restaurant. And a month into the restaurant, Ken confided in me that he didn't want to be the chef anymore at the restaurant, that I should be the chef because he was going to open his own place. So I said, cool. So I became the chef. And I was the chef at Michael's for 5 years, from 1979 to 1983.
Well, what kind of... Well, we're gonna have to go for a break here. But when we come back, I want you to start telling us when Jonathan's Cuisine started formulating, where it started becoming your own. And I think maybe that happened at Michael's. But
you're very astute, and absolutely, that's exactly what happened.
Okay, so we're going to take a little break here.
United States that has its own USDA inspected red meat abattoir or slaughterhouse and its own USDA inspected poultry abattoir or slaughterhouse. We partner with Whole Foods to deliver our high quality meat and poultry from Miami, Florida all the way to Princeton, New Jersey. One family, one farm, five generations, 145 years. A full circle return to sustainable land stewardship and humane animal stockmanship. For more information, please visit our website, whiteoakpastures.com.
Whoa, welcome back. This is Chef's Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton, interviewing Jonathan Waxman, who I personally think is one of the fathers of modern American cuisine. And Jonathan, I don't know about you, but I just love the way that man said abattoir. It so improves the French pronunciation.
And deliver.
And deliver. Anyway, we're sitting in Bushwick, Brooklyn. You know, we talk about accents. So let's get back. We were just talking to Jonathan about his background. And after a very eventful life, he became the chef at Michael's in Santa Monica, really at the beginning of this modern American cuisine.
Yeah, let me set the scene here. You have to understand it's 1979, and everything was French in those days. Mm-hmm. You know, everything was about France. It was, if you came from Germany, you did French food. If you came from England, you did French food. Everybody did French food. Mm-hmm. There were some Italian restaurants in New York that were very strong, but it was really about France. And what the big problem was finding ingredients. Nothing was available. Like, especially in L.A., the fishing industry was basically moribund. There wasn't any fish available. There just wasn't anything around. So little by little, we started begging, borrowing, stealing ideas and sources from other people. And it's funny. One day, this guy came to my back door with this box, and he said, I'm a pilot for Qantas Airlines, and I have a box I want you to see. So he opened the box up. Inside was the most beautiful John Dory you've ever seen in your life. Mm. And I said, where'd you get these? Oh, my brother's a fisherman in New Zealand. In New Zealand, I fly these up, and I'll fly them up once a week. And then one day, a guy named Joe Guerrero from Citarella Foods in New York, and now Citarella at that time was just a fish guy in the Fulton Market, he arrives with a box of this stuff. He says, look, I bought you striped bass and scallops from New York. And he used to fly out once a week and deliver me a box of fish Now, this is not sustainable. This is not, this is completely crazy. But I couldn't get anything. Soft-shell crabs. I never saw a soft-shell crab in my life. I'm from California. What was a soft-shell crab? Luckily, I had someone in my kitchen who was from Boston who taught me how to cut the gills out and do all that nonsense.
What do you eat out of the Pacific?
Yeah, very little. And then one day, somebody started bringing me spot prawns from Santa Barbara. Then I got abalone from the little abalone farm. And little by little, people started bringing me different things that were available. But what we turned to was there was a guy who raised rabbits and ducks, a wonderful squab guy in Carpinteria, a beautiful quail person up in Napa. So little by little, we were sourcing stuff all over California, from other places, obviously from New York and crazy places. And then one day somebody said, we have these lambs from Sonoma, and they brought them down. And, you know, so different things started to happen. And but vegetables, there was nothing available. You know, you had your standard. Back in the day, there was a red tomato, there was an orange, and there was a big black eggplant. Now we have heirloom varieties. That didn't really exist, that sort of thing. But I remember back when I was on the farm and my grandparents actually did heirloom stuff. We didn't know that they were heirloom. They thought they were weird and ugly, but they were heirloom.
And delicious.
But we didn't understand that whole thing. But my connected dot thing was I thought about what Alice had always said about seasonal food. I had traveled a bit by then. I had gone around and eaten a lot of restaurants. So I knew what was available in different parts of the country and in Europe. So I kind of was demanding things. And I was really forcing people to say, can you bring me the best butter, the best cream? Do I have to get the stuff that says, you know, like it's been ultra-pasteurized? Can I get something different? And little by little, there was Sadie Kendall was a goat cheese producer, and she brought me her stuff. You know, so little by the farmstead started to happen, and you know the artisanal farmer thing started to really come to bear. And it was slow, and it was difficult, and it was, you know, it was time consuming. But I loved it because we found and sourced all these different things, and I think the people really appreciated it. And you know, somebody brought me baby goats once. And I remember that Pierre Fanny came to dinner that night at the restaurant, and I served him what I thought was my rendition of Baby Goat, and he said, pretty good, you know?
Pierre Fanny was the chef, the executive chef of Le Pavillon, which was legendary in New York, and also the New York Times food editor, so...
Yeah, and I was, you know... But, you know, I have to remember the people that came to Michael's were, I mean, from Governor Reagan to, you know, Lillian Hellman to, you know, all the stars of Hollywood, and they were very demanding.
David Hockney.
Yeah, but they were very demanding people. They had been around the world. They were appreciative of the things that we were trying to do. Mm. And Michael, bless his heart, said, spend the money. Do what you need to do. You know, don't hold back. And so along the way, I started, you know, Michael had sort of a base menu that he had created at the beginning. And slowly but surely, what I started doing was creating my own dishes for the menu. Mm. And then one of the first dishes I did was I did this crazy salad of wild mushrooms that were sautéed and poured over a warm dressing over wilted lettuce and tossed with Smithfield ham. And this is sort of, people sort of think this is sort of the start of what we call a new American cuisine. It was just me fooling around, to be honest with you. And I was taking ingredients which I thought went well together and intelligently tried to put things together. And then people wouldn't let it go off the menu. I did this other dish. I learned how to make pasta from Piero Valentino's, and he taught me how to roll it out. He taught me how many egg yolks to use, and I fell in love because I had gone to Italy and I'd eaten white truffle pasta, and I thought, I got to bring this back. And Michael used to say, oh, buy all the white truffles you want. We had it all. You know, I used to chew on them at the line. And it was a crazy time. Oh. So, you know, I did this pasta dish I did with grilled scallops, and I made this sauce that was kind of a French vin blanc sauce, but I did it with California Chardonnay. All of a sudden, it became this sort of this dish that everybody loved. I couldn't take it off the menu. It was sort of became part of my lexicon. And, you know, along the way, I started realizing I was creating a little repertoire for myself. Mm-hmm. I didn't do it purposefully. It just started to happen. Mm-hmm. And it's what people grabbed here. I remember Gwyneth Paltrow's dad, Bruce Paltrow, asked me to make him some onion rings one night. And I said, we don't do onion rings, Bruce. He goes, yes, you can. And he's very, you know, okay, Bruce, we'll do it. So I made a beer batter with Heineken beer. And every time he came to the restaurant, he had to have my beer battered Heineken onion rings. And they became sort of a staple of the restaurant. So it was funny how the interaction between the guests and my cooks and, you know, Michael, and it was...
Did you know you were creating your own cuisine at that time?
Not at all. No, I had no idea what I was doing. But it was funny, back when I was in La Varenne, we used to sit around and talk about how great French food was, but how could it be done in an American style? How could we recreate it so that we used all the wonderful ingredients of America and sort of imbue it with French technique, but with our own sort of style? We did talk about that. It was an intellectual, you know, conversation.
So let me take a little side tour here. So James Beard is still alive at this time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Jim's food was authentic, American, traditional. Had he come to the restaurant? Did he ever eat your food? What was his opinion? Do you know if he had an opinion about this modern American?
Well, I know I had struck up a friendship with Larry Forgione at River Cafe. And I knew about James and Larry's relationship, that James really was Larry's mentor. Mm-hmm. And I was really in awe of what Larry was doing, because Larry had a forager. He was designing his own chickens. He was able to get all these different ingredients around the country. And Larry was much more advanced in that respect than I was. And Larry had a much better career at that point. He got into the CIA. He had worked at the Conrad Hotel in London. So Larry had a much better grasp. Larry was a much more rounded cook, even though he was younger. He had been in the cooking business a lot longer than I had. So I really kind of relied on Larry for my conversations a lot of the time. So I would call him up. I said, where did you get that that cream? Where did you get that ham from? Like the Smithfield ham thing, I want to know where he got it. And he would tell me. So there was collaboration going on. And then Michael got this idea that we were going to do a benefit for the AIWF, the American Institute of Wine and Food. And so he said, Waxman, you're the head chef for the event. I said, really? Because I'm your chef, I become... And so anyways, yeah, you can do it. And at that point, we tried to figure out how to bring in regional chefs from around America. And it was an event that took place in 1983 at the Stanford Court Hotel. And we went on the country, and I was clueless about a lot of the chefs who were in, like Bradley Ogden and Jimmy Schmidt and people like that. But we relied on people that were in the know, journalists and food writers and critics, sort of gave us through names in the hat. You know, I knew the obvious, like Paul Prudhomme and Wolfgang Puck and Alice Waters. Barbara Kafka came along, you know, and we threw this dinner together, and we filmed it, and it was just a really amazing, you know.
You filmed it. Where's the film today?
Michael has it, or someone has it. Anyway, so we filmed the event, and we did the precursor of the event, and we showed where the ingredients came from in different parts of America. And I think it was the first sort of codifying of what American food was about, or new American food. But with our one foot in tradition, one foot in kind of dangling into the new frontier, which is, I think, kind of where I liked being. I liked having that, you know, firm foot in technique and tradition, but my other foot kind of looking for something different.
Tap dancing.
Exactly.
Along the way.
I think so, just like musicians.
All right. So after Michael's, you know, what happened?
Well, it's funny. Michael was going to open a restaurant in New York, and I had that New York Jones. My father grew up in the Bronx. My mother grew up in Bed-Stuy. My father said there's no sense of reverse migration, but I said, you know, I got this Jones to go to New York. So when Michael's restaurant didn't happen in New York, I was having lunch at the Four Seasons restaurant with a guy named Melvin Master and his wife, Janie Master. And they said, we're going to open a restaurant in New York City. And Melvin is a famous wine merchant. His wife's an amazing cook. And they're very English. And they said, we're going to open a place called Billingsgate and do a fish place. I said, and they said, well, why don't you do it with us? I said, yeah, why not? So I quit Michael's. I moved to New York. And for 4 months, I tried to find a space with them. We couldn't find a space. The same time, I had bought a Ferrari, and I had the Ferrari in France. So I was driving around to different restaurants, and I finally went to Girardet, and I finally went to Bocuse and different places. So I did a tour of all the 3-star restaurants. I had to get that out of my system, and I did this with this buddy of mine who's a banker, and we had the best time. That's another story. But I came back from that little trip from that summer, and I said, Melvin, we got to find a space. And I was walking to Rosedale Fish Market, which at that time was on 78th and Lexington. And I walked down 79th Street, and I went by this little sign on the door, restaurant for rent, little handwritten thing. So I said, Melvin, you got to call this guy up. I'm too chicken shit to do it. So Melvin calls this guy up, and we found the space, and that's when jams happen.
Wow. And that took New York by storm.
But I had no clue, Dorothy. You have to understand something. I was really... I always sort of think that I'm a little naive, but I really was naive at that point. I didn't know anything about the big picture of New York City. I didn't realize how sort of most French restaurants had the exact same menu.
Exactly.
And I mean, they really did. Most Italian restaurants had they were afraid to go out of the box, sort of thing. And I can understand that from a businessman's point of view, that you didn't want to, you know, sort of get too far afield from your customer base. So when I opened up Jams, I didn't realize I was doing something totally radical and crazy and weird. All I knew was that one day I looked out and there's Andy Warhol, Woody Allen, and all these different people sitting in my restaurant, and I was kind of blown away. It was like, where did these people come from?
Were you the first one with the open kitchen?
Well, I wasn't the first one with the open kitchen, because, you know, open kitchens had been around forever. You know, there was a famous restaurant in San Francisco called Vanessi's, which you basically ate in the kitchen, and obviously Chez Panisse and different places like that. But I wanted a kitchen that exposed the cooks to the customer and vice versa. Mm-hmm. I wanted that interaction. I wanted that immediate sort of like walk by and wink, that was a really good meal kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And it was a peekaboo kitchen. It wasn't really in the middle of the dining room, but it's pretty funny. We opened up Jams. There was no stoves because it was a snowstorm. And on the East Coast, the stoves did not arrive. So for 2 weeks, I cooked on two Weber grills.
No.
I absolutely did.
Probably illegally.
Oh, I'm sure. Totally illegally.
can talk about it now, the statute of limitations.
Yeah, but you know, but you did what you had to do to get open. And it was just, I was flabbergasted by the response. I didn't really understand. But I had my little lexicon of dishes. I knew what I wanted.
It amazing to you that the New York Times would take such an interest in an American chef? I mean, in those days, you know, all the stars were dominated by the European.
Well, I'll tell you what, Dorothy. When it all sort of took place, and I was really kind of, I didn't really understand. But when Andre Soltner came for dinner with his wife one night, that blew me away. And he didn't make a reservation. He walked in quietly, sort of a table, and I didn't realize he was there. And said, the chef from the test is here. So I walked upstairs, and he's, you know how formally he dresses. And he was so helpful when I first came to New York. He told me about where to get different ingredients, talked about the health department, talked about the building inspectors. He was like my uncle.
He was
so
wonderful.
Mm. You have to realize that, you know, I'm just this kid from California. He didn't have to tell me anything. Mm. But he really took me aside. And then to have him show up at the restaurant and eat, because I know he never did that. Mm. He was famous. Once a year to show up at my restaurant that I knew kind of that I was accepted.
Okay, we're going to have to take another break. I'm going to put a little plug in here. We do have Andre Soltner. We have interviewed him on this program. So download it on iTunes or your MP3, and you'll see what a great man he is. But we'll be back in a minute. We're going to take a break.
Thank you.
HeritageRadioNetwork.org is the most trusted media outlet for real, quality conversations about food. That experience will come to life at our first annual members-only fundraiser party on September 9th from 5 to 8 p.m. at Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Enjoy the best food in the world from talent including Michael Anthony, award-winning chef from Gramercy Tavern, Brooks Headley, award-winning pastry chef from Del Posto, Shauna Pacifico at Back 40 West, sustainable seafood from sea to table, and much more, including drinks made by Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues, craft beer from Greenpoint Harbor Brewery, wine from Cane Vineyard and Winery in the Napa Valley, and plenty more. Radio is back, and this will be a special, exclusive experience in the back garden of Roberta's that you don't want to miss. September 9th, 5 to 8 p.m. Buy tickets at heritageradionetwork.eventbrite.com.
Okay, well, welcome back. You're listening to Chef's Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton, speaking with Jonathan Waxman. And now, Jonathan, we've gone through this amazing, you know, road journey with your life. Very eventful. I wish I was there. But let's get to where you are today at Barbudo, which is one of the hottest restaurants down in the very West Village. Tell me, how did that come about? What are you trying to do there?
Well, I had a restaurant called Washington Park, and it was very fancy and sort of reminiscent of what Jams was. And I didn't realize that I wasn't happy with it. It wasn't really me. And I had one Christmas Eve, my wife said, "We have new neighbors upstairs in our apartment in the Upper West Side," and then there's an Italian couple, big bear-like Italian guy and his beautiful little wife, and we should invite him down and be nice for champagne for Christmas Eve. So we invited him down, and there we had a pleasant conversation. That was it. And Sally calls me up about a week later. She said, "We're really kind of dumb because it's Alessandro Ferri, the famous ballet dancer from ABT." And then a week later, she calls me, "We're doubly stupid because it's Fabrizio Ferri, who's the famous fashion photographer from Italy." And Fabrizio and I struck up a friendship, and he said, I have my studio downtown in the West Village on 12th and Washington, and I have this great space that you should do a restaurant in." I said, "I don't want to do another restaurant." So he said, "No, come down and see it." So I went down to see it, and it's kind of a garage, it's kind of a dump, and I said, "No, I don't want to do it." Kept pestering me. Finally, I said, "Okay, well, let's just do it. We'll figure it out." He goes, "Let's go to an Italian restaurant." I said, "I'm a Jewish kid from Berkeley, California. I don't do Italian. I love Italian, but I don't do it." And he goes, "You know what? You cook exactly like my Roman grandmother.
No.
Simplistically, from your heart, and you don't make mistakes." I said, "That sounds pretty good." So I decided to open an Italian restaurant. And I was very lucky. I had Lynn McNeely, who was my chef from Washington Park, who was a real strong Italian cook. He really had a good background in Italian food. And then I had my background of going to eat in Italy all over the place and, you know, having studied a lot about Bugiali was my favorite book, and Marcello, of course. You know, I devoured their books, you know, backwards and forwards. So we opened up this Italian restaurant. I didn't think anybody would come. So I didn't have a manager, didn't have point of sale. We opened this place up. All of a sudden, kaboom, everybody started coming. And it's now evolved into this kind of, it's sort of my favorite thing I've ever done in my life. And what I feel great about Barbudo is that it's not just Italian, and it's not just New York, and it's not just me. It's a real relationship between my customers, my farmers, my purveyors, my wine guys. It's a big, fat collaboration amongst all of us. And I listen to my customers. I think they listen to me. And any given night, it's like a big party. I love it. I don't know why it's like a big party, but it is. And we've got a wide demographic net. We've got families with kids running around making a huge mess, which we love. We've got sophisticated people. We've got out-of-towners. God bless Michelin Guide. We've got people that watch me on TV from Korea and every place else in Asia. We've got my friends from California. It's a really great milieu. There's a lot
of... You were saying you've got a lot of women.
It's very women-friendly. For some reason, 60% of our customers are women. And, you know, I've tried to analyze it before. I've talked to, you know, people at Daily Candy trying to figure out, you know, why this is. And a lot of people say it's because your bar is not a liquor bar. It's a wine-centric bar. Mm-hmm. The food is very sort of well, woman friendly, whatever that means. I have no idea what they're really saying. But I think the price point is important. Mm-hmm. I think presentation is important. I think a lot of it is that, you know, we try to do things in a careful but fun fashion. I think mm-hmm. women really appreciate it. And you know what? I get tables of women all the time. I just think it's the greatest thing in the world. And, you know, I'm just happy people are coming to the restaurant.
Given your background and the success of Barbudo, I mean, it's like you have it all. You know, Obi-Wan Kenobi on TV. Every young chef looks up to you as a great legend and mentor. So what's exciting for you these days?
Well, you know, it's funny. You just hit the nail on the head about young and old chefs that I really respect. Anybody who's willing to take a risk, willing to put themselves out there. You know, I love all this strum and drung of all these new ideas. And we're sitting in Roberta's, one of the, you know, bastions of that behavior. People doing things on a shoestring and doing it well and really caring more about the food than anything else. And it really reminds me of how I started out and what my goals were. And I think that it's good for everybody to embrace each other and to learn. I think I can learn a lot from young people. I think they hopefully can learn things from me. But the main thing is that we're in an industry that is growing. It's exciting. It's getting bigger and better. And I think now we're starting to realize that food doesn't come in a box. And back in the day, food came in a box. Came from a purveyor in a box in a plastic bag. Now I realize that the real heroes here are the farmers, the ranchers, the fishermen. Those are the people that we really have to owe our lives to. I feel like I'm really a custodian for what they do. Like if somebody brings me a perfect piece of fish, I'm not going to muck around with it too much. I'm not going to play with it with tweezers. I'm not going to put a lot of little dangling things on top of it. I'm going to take the fish. I'm going to clean it. I'm going to wash it. I'm going to dry it, put some olive oil on it. I'm going to grill it and serve it the way it is, because that's what I think is the most respectful thing to the fish and to the person that caught it. So I think that kind of philosophy is really the most important thing. You know, synthesizing, you know, cuisine down to the bare essentials is really what good food's about.
Now, wait, let's explore that a little bit. If you're saying do the simplest thing with the fish, then if you have 10 great chefs that have extraordinary technique, if they're going to do the simplest thing with the fish, how do they infuse their personality?
Some people have better technique than others. I don't have very good technique. I know chefs that have the most amazing technique, and they can take that simple fish in 2 seconds, like Jean-Georges. He'll do it entirely different than I will. I know what he will do. He'll dust it with flour and leave the scales on and grill it with the scales on. He'll do it differently than I do, which I think is the great thing about chefs. Everybody will look at that fish differently. 10 chefs, same fish, they'll all do it differently. And I think that's extraordinary. If you give it to April Bloomfield, she'll look at it, she'll do something, she might do something entirely different from her perspective. You bring it to someone like David Chang, he might do it in a style that, you know, is, I wouldn't even understand, but I think that's gorgeous. You know, so I think that's the great thing about being a chef these days, that we've got so many different, you know, back in the day, you know, there was very few ethnic restaurants that one went to. Now you have the choice, especially in New York City. You can go to anything. The whole world has come to us. You don't have to travel. You can go to Queens or Brooklyn or anything. And you know what? That to me is really exciting. When I grew up, I didn't know anything about Thai food. Now we're getting to know Thai food pretty well. But what about Malaysian food? What about, you know, India for me is a huge, huge sort of enigma. I don't really understand it. I'd like to know more about it. And China, forget about it. The Chinese food is just amazing. So I think that as a cook, you have to kind of edit yourself. You have to pick and choose where your influences do come from. You have to figure out what you're excited about. You have to figure out what ingredients speak to you, because I think speaking is very important. I think ingredients have to talk to you. Like, for instance, Chris Bianco and I we talk about flour all day long, about different kinds of flour, where wheat is grown, how it's harvested, who grinds it, where is it carried by, what hybrid it is. That's so exciting. I love that. I love that about my industry, and I think that it's only going to get better.
Well, we're running out of time. I'd like you to be I think there are a lot of young chefs who would love to know you, work with you. What advice, in closing, would you have for anyone out there who is a young chef or wants to be a chef? What makes a chef?
Well, I think it's very simple. Number one is that you have to be humble. Number two is that you have to listen. Number three, you have to eat in everybody's restaurant as much as possible, no matter what you can do. Number four, you need to understand about collaboration, because no person is an island. You need to understand that you learn things from everybody, from a dishwasher to the waiter to the customer to the other cooks to people out in the world. You have to understand that everybody has something to offer. And your job as a chef is to be patient with yourself, not go too fast. Go at your own pace. Some people are faster runners. Some people are slower runners. It doesn't matter. Define yourself, to codify who you are as a cook takes the right amount of time. What that means, I'm not quite sure, but you have to figure that out for yourself. And the other thing to do is to, I think reading is so important. Reading, getting into the text of what the history of food is. It's been really helpful for me. I read a thing about Jose Andres, that he has this amazing collection of cookbooks from America that he reads all the time. He wants to understand what American food's about. So he reads old texts from, you know, from Boston or wherever. To me, that's so important, to understand where we've come as a culture, where we've come as a food-loving culture, but understanding the history of it, I think. I love, like Elizabeth David, I read her all the time. She's my bedside little mentor. And I read about her, and I'm still flabbergasted about how smart she was.
Okay. Thank you, Jonathan.
You're welcome.
It's been wonderful. You've been listening to Chef Story, and this is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. Stitcher? Heritage Radio Network is on it, so get it. Stitcher is an award-winning provider of news and talk radio for your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio.